Afternoon, ma'am. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a few minutes will be fine.
3 minutes.
Thank you. Ready?
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is Lou Alupis, and I'm here on behalf of James Melvin Howard. Mr. Howard was convicted of 2 counts of possession of Schedule 1 or 2 narcotics, specifically 1 count of possession of heroin and 1 count of possession of fentanyl.
All of which were in the same container.
Correct, Your Honor. It was
all the same color.
Correct. The capsule was found during a pat-down of Mr. Howard during a traffic stop, and it was found in his right pocket, and the testimony...
His pants pocket.
Pants pocket. He was wearing a cargo shorts, I believe, and it was in that cargo-type pocket on the side.
So as they are patting or searching him, and they have him have his hands on his head, right... He keeps moving his hands, but he keeps looking at that pocket, is the testimony from the officer.
Correct. I believe Officer Kath testified that she had instructed him to put his hands over his head, lace his fingers, and he did drop his hands a couple of times when he had to be redirected, and that he kept looking down at what she was doing. Officer Elliott also testified about the encounter, and he testified that Mr. Howard was compliant and not fidgety and didn't put his hands in his pockets. So there's a little bit of a...
Wasn't there testimony, though, that he actually kept looking at that pocket, toward that pocket?
I believe Officer Kath's testimony, Your Honor, was that he kept looking down at that side.
Okay.
I don't know if it was the specific... I don't remember if it was the specific...
Is it reasonable to infer from that gesture that he was concerned about what was in his pants pocket? I keep looking down.
I know how the court would view that, and I believe the trial court did find that that was some part of the showing evidence that of a guilty knowledge. But our position is that the evidence was not sufficient to convict him of both of these offenses. Our position is that to be found guilty of both, the Commonwealth attorney had to present evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of that knowledge of both substances.
What would happen in a case where a person has marijuana, let's say, and you have some marijuana on your possession, and it appears that after further investigation that marijuana has been treated with PCP, which in some of the drug culture that indeed does happen, is that the marijuana has PCP therein, and you are... Let's assume for sake of discussion that the arrest is fine and that the search is fine and that item is recovered. Could the person be convicted of both possession of marijuana and possession of PCP, or should the Commonwealth have to make an election, or would the evidence fail on both?
I believe the Commonwealth would have to still prove knowledge of both the marijuana and the PCP, and it's not just knowledge of the substances, but the nature and character of both. And I believe the trial court in this case, and I was not trial counsel, even proposed a hypothetical to defense counsel about marijuana laced with something else, and gave some other hypotheticals. And our position would be the same, that as long as the Commonwealth could prove the knowledge element of both the marijuana and the PCP, or marijuana and another substance, then the defendant would be able to be convicted.
That sort of create a circular analysis that, all right, he knew that he was smoking something, but he didn't know if it was marijuana or PCP. And so since he didn't know which one he was smoking, he can't be convicted of either?
I don't know that would be our
position.
You said
the Commonwealth have to prove it. So
right.
How would the Commonwealth prove it?
Well, I mean, knowledge can be proven by the defendant's acts, conducts, statements.
I'm getting ready to say something that's not true, so I'm not trying to make this difficult for you. Yes, I am trying to make it difficult for you.
But of course.
If the defendant has a substance that he knows to be an illegal substance, but he doesn't know what that illegal substance is, does that negate the ability of the Commonwealth to prove culpability for the possession of a controlled substance?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that's this court's holding in Sierra, that if it's a controlled substance, the court doesn't concern itself necessarily with which controlled substance it is. If the defendant thinks it's marijuana,
he thinks it's cocaine, turns out it's heroin or vice versa.
Correct. Then he's still guilty of possession of a controlled substance. I think in the marijuana PCP analogy, and I am not speaking from personal experience, obviously, but my understanding is that there would be some visual distinction between a green or brown leafy marijuana and
also
a PCP.
Also not speaking from personal experience, but if you have it in a joint, you can't tell what you're smoking.
No, but wouldn't, and again, not personal experience, wouldn't a defendant have to pay more for a marijuana cigarette that had something else in it?
Not if the person who's selling it to him is trying to get them to become a user.
Okay, I think, and that would be something I think that those facts would have to be, you know, brought out at the in the trial
Judge
court.
Olson reveals the true source of his knowledge. is it your position that he could be convicted of one of the two drugs, but not both?
As I stated earlier, Your Honor, our position is the evidence was insufficient for both of these convictions. But clearly the trial court felt there was knowledge of both. So if you're looking at just the evidence in this case, which was very limited in terms of evidence of the guilty knowledge, really all you have is Officer Kath's testimony that she told him to put his hands on his head and he didn't comply and had to be redirected, and he was looking down at that area as she was patting him down. That was in conflict with Officer Elliott's testimony that he was not fidgety, he didn't put his hands in his pockets.
The trial court resolved that.
Exactly.
But I guess my question is, assuming that his failure to put failure to keep his hands on his head and him looking toward his pants pocket, assuming that shows guilty knowledge, is that guilty knowledge of both drugs where none of the experts could visually tell the difference?
No, Your Honor. I would have to disagree with that respectfully. I would say that would only be guilty knowledge of possession of a controlled substance. And I think that's even a stretch, but I will concede that that could be possession of a controlled substance.
Looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the prevailing party, could the evidence show that he had guilty knowledge of one of those two drugs?
Looking at the evidence in light most favorable to the Commonwealth, then most likely yes. Because that would be, and I've seen these in other cases too, where the furtive movements, putting the hands down, that is deemed
guilty knowledge. But your position is that doesn't mean that he has guilty knowledge of both drugs.
Yes, Your Honor.
When the expert said we couldn't tell.
Right. That was the stipulation for the analyst.
The lab report said it couldn't visually tell the difference between the heroin and the fentanyl.
Correct.
Is that how you distinguish this case from Sierra? There's one capsule that looks the same even when you open it up?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no evidence that Mr. Howard knew there was that pill had two substances in there. And our position is, and we are distinguishing from Sierra, because our position is that when an analysis came back with two substances, that did not relieve the Commonwealth of its burden to prove the guilty knowledge of both substances in order to sustain those convictions.
So you do agree, based upon your answer to Judge Frank's question, you do agree that in this case, theoretically, the Commonwealth could have gotten an inconsistent verdict, i.e. guilty of one yet not guilty of the other.
Yes.
Okay, which is inconsistent with one of your colleagues said this morning, that you can't do that. You got it.
Different cases, different facts.
Counsel, assuming we agree that there was sufficient evidence to prove he possessed one of the two, what does this court do?
That's the question, Your Honor.
That's why I asked it.
Yes, Your Honor. I've done quite a bit of research. I had my intern as well researching, and I did present some other cases in my brief that were just for information, some military cases. I think the statute itself doesn't really address an appropriate remedy, because the statute talks about a controlled substance.
But I think the answer to the question is that if this is a sufficiency case and we determine that the evidence was insufficient to convict, then the result or the remedy is dismissal.
Yes.
If we look at it from a sufficiency case.
Yes.
We can't send this case back to the trial court and say, we need you to tell us what you are convicting this person of, because you can't convict him of both.
Correct.
All right.
So you think there's no way it can be remanded for additional fact-finding of which this might be, given the trial court found him guilty of both?
I don't know. I mean, if the court reversed and remanded and there was a new trial, I think we're still stuck with that same set of facts. I don't see the facts are going to still be the same. The certificate analysis is going to be the same. There were no statements or admissions by Mr. Howard. Officer Katz's testimony would not change.
I think we really would have a Blockberger problem.
I mean, it would be... All the facts would still be the same. There would not be any new information.
So it would be a double jeopardy issue at that point, or not?
Twice placed in jeopardy for the same crime.
I would have to agree that it would, although I know the Commonwealth brought up double jeopardy in her brief in opposition, which I did not focus on in my brief because the trial counsel didn't address that at all, really.
Well, he couldn't have anticipated the nature of where the analysis would go. So
most likely.
But heroin and fentanyl, there was testimony that they often are together, right? That fentanyl is used to lace heroin?
I believe that was some of the trial courts posing some hypotheticals to defense counsel about various combinations of substances. And I think that's one of the reasons why this case is so unique, is because as practitioners, we're used to these cutting agents being things like baby laxatives and cornstarch. And, I mean, I don't know the recipe, obviously, but now here we're faced with a situation where the cutting agent is actually another controlled substance. And again, I don't think that relieves the Commonwealth of its burden of having to prove that guilty knowledge of both of those substances.
You're in your rebuttal time, if you can save it for the rest if you'd like.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll save it just in case. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth. Good afternoon again.
This you were Victoria Johnson earlier today.
I am still Victoria Johnson, and I will probably remain to be so for the rest of my life, as far as I know.
Help us work our way through this. Your opponent colleague has done a very good job of sort of pointing out for us that this is an unusual situation where you have two substances that are found in one capsule, and these substances are distinct but indiscernible by looking at them. And the trial judge in this case did not make an election as to which one he was going to find the defendant guilty of. And we don't have the traditional information or evidence to suggest that the defendant was aware that he was using something that was a combination of two illicit substances. How do we get to the point of the government being able to prove its case when it comes down to the knowledge component of the case?
I submit...
Excuse me. The bottom line is for this defendant to be convicted of both offenses, he would have to have knowledge of each separate of the two drugs.
I submit that this case is controlled by Sierra, Your Honors. In Sierra, this court held that I'm going to use Latin terms, and I already apologize because I will mispronounce them, that the mens re, the guilty knowledge element, is general. It's a general intent to possess a controlled substance. Or contraband might be a better way to put
it. Is a mens rea to have a controlled substance?
A controlled substance.
Then whatever you have, even if it's numerous controlled substances in one capsule, you're guilty of. Is that the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. That is my argument. There's the intent to possess contraband, and then the actus reus is the actual substance itself. And if it happens to be more than one substance, then that intent, I believe, follows from the Sierra opinion. That guilty knowledge that you are possessing contraband covers all of the contraband that you possess.
And what's the evidence that this defendant had knowledge that he had contraband?
He was acting in a furtive way, and at appendix page 78, a point of clarification from earlier argument, the officer, Kath, was asked... He was at the rear of the vehicle, in front of our vehicle, so between the two cars, and I had him put his hands on top of his head and interlock his fingers. He kept taking his hands down as I was searching him and looking towards that. And the prosecutor said, you know, clarify what that is. And when you say looking towards that, do you mean the pocket where you eventually located narcotics? Correct, yes. So he was nervous during the time when he was being searched. You know, the officers pulled him over, had this strong smell of marijuana, which gave him the probable cause to search.
Let me interrupt you.
Yes.
So your argument is that by these furtive gestures, mm-hmm. that showed that he had knowledge of a substance.
That he was possessing contraband.
And under Sierra, the fact that he knew that he had one substance, you can infer that he knew he had the other.
I'm not sure that it's that you infer from his guilty knowledge of one substance. I think that it's his knowledge that he possesses contraband, you know, drug contraband of whatever nature. And then the two acts, the actus reus, are the heroin and the fentanyl. And I think that that's supported in the federal cases that were discussed in Sierra.
That's a different standard, though, in the federal system.
Well, but in Sierra, we adopted the way that the federal drug, I believe the distribution statute, is interpreted. This court adopted that interpretation because in Sierra, the court talked about you have the intent to possess contraband, you know, illegal drug contraband, without necessarily having to know the precise makeup of what you possess, the chemical makeup. And that's what we have here. We have someone who had guilty knowledge that he was possessing drug contraband, and we know that from his reactions when he was being searched. But that's what the Commonwealth proves. And then the act itself is the chemical makeup to
take your argument to its logical conclusion, and correct me if I'm not saying this right, is if you can show that you have a mens rea to that you're possessing a controlled substance, mm-hmm. that if that controlled substance turns out to be a mix of five controlled substances, you can be convicted of five felonies, because it's sort of strict liability once you have an intent to possess one controlled substance.
And I think that that's the logical outcome from the Sierra case, where the mens rea was defined as being sort of the general intent to possess contraband, and the actus rea was the actual chemical makeup. So here in this case, the Commonwealth proved the guilty knowledge, you know, by his nervous actions, looking down at the pants pocket and watching everything that the officer did, and his, you know, disregarding Officer Kath's instructions to keep his hands on his head. You know, from that, and, you know, from those facts, you can infer that guilty knowledge.
But you got, even under Sierra, you have to still show that the defendant knew that each substance was controlled, don't you?
I don't recall that being specifically stated in Sierra.
Well, is that a reasonable inference from Sierra?
Your Honor, my reading of Sierra, and I know it sounds a little strange, is that once you have the general intent to possess contraband, then whatever's in that pill or that baggie or that joint, you're liable for. And the Sierra Court relied on some federal cases, most notably United States v. Obie, which is actually a federal sentencing case that talks about the volume of drugs, even if the defendant doesn't know the precise volume of drugs that he possesses, but he knows he's possessing drugs, but he doesn't know the whole volume, then there can be sentencing enhancements based on that volume, because Congress, for the purposes of deterrence, has decided that criminal folks who are engaged in drug trafficking and drug possession bear that risk. And I submit that that's kind of in the same vein that we're in now. If you possess a controlled substance, you bear that risk.
So in Sierra, are you referring to, I'm looking at it, the language that says the specific type of substance found in a defendant's possession is an actus reus element the Commonwealth must prove pursuant to 18.2-250A, but it is not an element to which the mens rea requirement found earlier in the statute applies.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what I'm relying on.
And there's additional language that we hold that the defendant needs only show that he's possessing a controlled substance to be guilty of violating 18.2-250, a claim by a defendant that he knew he was possessing a controlled substance but was unaware or mistaken to the precise identity of that substance is not a defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
The only thing I noticed there, though, is that in every case, controlled substance is in the singular.
Yes, Your Honor. And, well, I think I might have been going on a bit of a tangent because I misunderstood the reason that the defendant cited that the military cases. I think that some of the unit of prosecution cases that I cited in my brief actually speak to that in some way. For instance, several of the cases, and I'll just flip here so I can reference them a little bit better. I beg your pardon, Your Honors.
I've got your brief.
I'm looking at pages 7 through 8 in my brief. The Wells v. Alabama case talks about Alabama statute that prescribes possessing a controlled substance, just like 18.2-250, reflects a legislative intent to treat each type of controlled substance separately. So,
to get to the point that you're trying to take us to, would we necessarily have to say that this is a strict liability crime?
No, Your Honor, it's not a strict liability crime.
But would we necessarily have to say that, though?
No, Your Honor, you would not, because the Commonwealth still has to prove the knowledge, the guilty knowledge.
So as long as you have guilty knowledge, then it becomes strict liability.
Well, if you have guilt, my understanding of a strict liability crime is that you don't have any knowledge or intent.
Strict liability says it doesn't matter the circumstances which causes you to be in the situation. You are liable for it, notwithstanding the circumstances. That's the way I understand strict liability.
My understanding of the Sierra case is that the Commonwealth only has to prove guilty knowledge to possess contraband. And the actus reus is that contraband was actually possessed.
And whatever that contraband is
enough to prove 18.2 to prove violation of 18.2-250. If the defendant disclaims, and that's kind of the situation we're in here, if the defendant says, oh, I thought that I possessed marijuana, but really it was PCP, or there's some argument to that effect, that's not a defense.
No.
And I submit that kind of avoiding that circular reasoning that we're in danger of getting in, where you have I know the trial court highlighted the concern that, you know, folks would come in and admit, oh, I knew that I was possessing the Schedule
but then,
4.
But
I didn't know about the Schedule 1.
That sort of gets us to the circular logic. You're saying that there's no need for us to make a determination that this is a strict liability crime But you're also saying that you don't have any responsibility to prove any mens rea.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay, help me out.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear. Under Sierra, my understanding of Sierra, and I apologize if I'm completely off the boat, but this is really what I believe it says. My understanding of Sierra is Sierra held that under 18.2.250, you have to have, the Commonwealth must prove that the defendant had the intent to possess contraband.
Not
the precise nature, or a controlled substance. A controlled substance.
I was using marijuana and
cocaine.
He said a controlled substance. You have to prove that there was guilty knowledge that you possessed that controlled substance, intent to possess that. But the precise chemical makeup of that controlled substance, as long as it, you know, it comes back from DFS, you got the certificate of analysis, and it shows what it is, as long as that's a controlled substance, that's okay. You don't have to show that the defendant knew the precise nature of the chemical makeup of that substance. Or in this case, substances. And I submit that it's a logical outpouring of Sierra that the intent kind of covers both possessions.
Okay, so the mens rea requirement comes with the possession of the item itself or the contraband itself.
Yes.
The nature of it does not go to mens rea. You don't have to prove mens rea regarding the nature of it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
As long as it's a controlled substance.
Right. Okay.
You know.
Okay.
You know, if I was possessing aspirin and I thought it was, I don't know, morphine. I mean, that'd be a different situation.
If he had a joint in the pocket,
does it have to be me?
I have no idea. There's PCP on it, as opposed to a capsule.
Right.
Then maybe you don't have the mens rea that it's a controlled substance versus contraband of marijuana or whatever.
Right,
Your Honor. I think that you could. I don't know. Maybe. These hypotheticals are always so awkward. Maybe you thought it was clothes. You thought you were possessing clothes.
We kind of go with hypotheticals because we try not to write opinions that are so broad where we get confused, like maybe Sierra is.
I understand that, Your Honor. It is confusing because it feels very
counterintuitive.
Yep. You feel like you should always have, you know, everything in a neat little package where
you have one capsule with it all looking the same even when you break it open.
And
I think that's what's troubling people.
Well, and I think, and I understand that, Your Honor, but I think that in the cases that were cited in Sierra, some of those federal cases, and that I in turn kind of cited on brief, and I have to say, I did not find a case that was on all fours with this one, and I did a right good bit of research. I did not find a case that involved one pill that was a sufficiency issue like this. I think the closest I came was some double jeopardy stuff, unit of prosecution type stuff. And I think that may be because of how the federal law is interpreted as expressed in Sierra. But, you know,
it's almost like, and obviously this this is a civil theorem, it's almost like an assumption of risk. If you assume the risk of getting involved and taking and consuming and possessing illegal things, then you assume the risk of whatever's in them and being prosecuted for same.
And my time has expired, but I'd be happy to. I think that is not inaccurate, Your Honor. I think that the statutes have been, both the federal statute and in Sierra, our 18.2.250 statute, has been construed in a manner where you look at the legislative intent to deter drug use, and we see that throughout the code. You know, these are pretty heavy penalties. And you, by intending to possess a controlled substance, you're kind of on the hook for whatever you wind up possessing.
Okay, can I follow up to one other question on this? If the court, I'm just saying if, I'd like your direction or your advice on this. If the court were to decide that the evidence were not enough to convict for both, what is the Commonwealth's view of what we should do then? Can we affirm one and reverse and dismiss the other? Do we need to can we remand it for the trial court to do additional fact-finding based on our opinion? Do we need to just reverse and dismiss both of them? What do we do?
I feel like I may be shooting myself in the foot by saying this, but in candor with the court, my understanding is that the remedy for a sufficiency challenge on appeal is reverse and dismiss.
You got to pitch them all.
It cannot be retried because that indeed would be a double jeopardy violation.
Not a 294.
Yes, not a 294.
Well, what about this? What about if we reverse one, remanded back not for a trial, but for sentencing. Sentencing only because there's going to be only one sentencing event now.
Yes, Your Honor. That is something you could do, I believe.
But how could we pick which one we want to reverse?
In double jeopardy land, the one that you pick to reverse is the lesser crime. I have seen nothing in a sufficiency context, though.
So reverse the lesser crime and remand for resentencing
on the greater.
On the greater. Mm-hmm. So you'd, I believe this is a 1 and 2, so you'd reverse the 2 and remand for sentencing on the 1.
Reverse the fentanyl and remand
for the heroin.
I think that's kind of shaky.
Mm-hmm.
That does feel a little shaky to me. Although if the Commonwealth could get that, we'd take it. But I'm not sure that's
the Supreme Court.
And then the Supreme Court can talk to me. Well, I have a feeling I might be heading that way. In this
There's
case.
There's always the ability for resolution of disputes.
Yeah. And my time has obviously expired, but
we
I'd
used
ask
it
all
up,
the firm.
So that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. Help us through this quandary.
It's a quandary, I admit.
I know your suggestion is dismiss both of them and call it a day.
I like that one. I like that one very much, Your Honor. I'm sure Mr. Howard would be thrilled.
What do you think on the reverse on one and remand for resentencing on the other?
Well, of course, and I can see that as a compromise, Your Honor, but Mr. Howard's position is obviously that the evidence was not sufficient to convict him of both, so I could not concede.
Of course, I understand that.
To
and
that.
I wouldn't ask you to, but just assuming, you know, I asked the if question to you as I did of Ms. Johnson. If the court found, that's a different question, but with an if, big if before, if we found that there was the necessary general mens rea that he had the general mens rea, or that a rational fact finder could conclude he had the general mens rea of possessing a controlled substance, then what do we do? If we decide that it can't be both, given it's a capsule with looking the same as you pointed out throughout, even when it's opened, can we reverse on one and remand for resentencing on the other?
I think that would be a possible outcome. And I agree with Ms. Johnson that it would have to be in getting rid of the lesser.
Reversing and dismissing the lesser one, the fentanyl.
Right. But again, this is a quandary. This is why we're here, because this is a quandary. But I did want to just address a couple of the points that she made. Excuse me. Ms. Johnson used the word contraband numerous times in her argument, and the statute doesn't say contraband. The statute says a controlled substance.
I think we might have done that to her because we used the term contraband, and she sort of stayed within the terminology that we were using.
Okay. I don't agree that it would be a strict liability that if you show the guilty knowledge of one and if there's five, that now you're guilty of all five. That's why we're here, because the trial court, I guess, believed that there was evidence of the guilty knowledge of...
But if we look at it like that, the legislative intent of the statute generally is to criminalize the possession of both of the substances that were found in the capsule. Would you agree?
Possession of a controlled substance,
yes.
Yes. And
meant
both
to criminalize
of them.
Both of them.
Right.
And in this case, there's no doubt that he possessed both of them. The question is whether or not he knew the nature of what he was possessing.
Correct. Correct.
And the language in, I'll read you the same language I read to her, the specific type of substance found in a defendant's possession is an actus reus element. The Commonwealth must prove pursuant to 18.2-258, but is not an element to which the mens rea requirement found in the statute applies, that from Sierra.
Correct.
So, yes, it does refer to substance in the singular, but it seems to imply that if that you have a mens rea to possess a controlled substance, that the what the controlled substance is the actus reus, not the mens rea.
Correct. And that's why our position is you still have to show that guilty knowledge for each substance. And then the actus reus part, which in 18.2-250 comes in those subsections A, B, and C, which deals with the levels and the corresponding punishments that go along with the specific substances.
But again, we all agree that the legislature intended to criminalize the possession of both of these substances. And if the legislative intent is to criminalize both of these substances, our responsibility and the responsibility of the trial judge is to interpret these statutes consistent with the legislative intent, which then gets us to the point of theoretically you can be convicted of both of them.
As long as the Commonwealth has proved the guilty knowledge.
Yes, ma'am. All right. We've taken up a lot of your time.
I know. Thank you so much.
Right. It's an interesting case, well presented by both counsel.
Thank you.
All right.